Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are here live for another long-format episode after last week's just a catch-up episode. Sadly, but not too sadly, we're proud of him. Jeff is not going to be here today because he is heading out to welcome his son at post cavalry training and before he heads off on his assignment. So Jeff is out doing the family thing. He will catch us up next week. Dennis is here despite the fact that Texas didn't want him to be any part of this episode. They said, hey, we're not going to just shut down your internet. We're going to kill the power at your house. But Dennis said, nay, I got a truck, I got a wheel, and I got somebody with power and internet. So he packed up his equipment head on out. But more importantly, our guest of the night, Robert, I got to say, first and foremost, you're breaking some boundaries here. I think you are the first fiction writer in this genre on the show. But I got to tell you, Dennis and I, we are, I'm going to get a little hillbilly adult vernacular here. We're happier than a puppy of two Peters to read this book because it is fantastic. Sir, your book, Jeep Show, A Trooper at the Battle of the Bulge, a novel by Mr. Robert B. O'Connor. This is a masterclass on how to take historical content, add some fictional characters, and make it such a good read. We'll get into that a little bit more here in a bit because I want to get your background. But just, this is a fantastic book, and I know I'm shining here, but we'll get into it here in a little bit why. But first and foremost, let's get the background on you.
Sure.
How did you get into, I guess first and foremost, how did the World War II bug bite you?
Well, my father, like most men my age, my father was in World War II. He was overseas, and his younger brother, my uncle, was in the Navy in the Pacific, combat veteran. Naturally, they never said a word about it, nonetheless, I had that interest. I've always been a history buff, I stumbled onto the existence of this thing called a Jeep Show. I was going to write about a gentleman who was a circus promoter. And I was actually going to write a nonfiction about a certain circus he did. In my research, I talked to his daughter, and she told me about his service in World War II. The gentleman's name was Jim Hetzer, and he had tried to make it in show business in New York in the 38 and 39. He had not made it. He became a dance instructor, and then he joined the Army in 1944 at the age of 29, despite having a deferment as the parent of a child. As you well know, local draft boards were very reluctant to draft fathers. He wanted to be paratrooper, but they, because of his entertainment background, they put him in what is actually called special services, what I call in the book Morale Corps, which was actually the name of it up until 1942.
Do you know, was there a defined line of demarcation between special services, entertainment, and then those that we know as the news reporters and the people actually filmed combat in some of the training videos? Was that a completely different department, or were they kind of
completely different department? The film, the cameramen who were shooting or filming battles would be Signal Corps, as I recall. And Special Services was part of Army Corps. And yeah, its own thing. And they did, as you well know, the book is about one aspect of what they did, which is small variety shows for combat infantrymen who would be pulled back from the line for a day for shower, hot meal, possibly even a uniform, exchange. And these shows were in places, they were within artillery range of the German artillery often, and the USO could not go there. Too dangerous, too difficult to get there. So he, this actual person was assigned MOS 442, that is entertainment soldier, and was put in the what I call the morale corps. He wrote, as most soldiers did, he wrote home from the European Theater of Operations, and his older sister saved every letter
Oh,
that he
God bless
wrote.
her.
I know, primary sources, primary sources.
Yeah, we
Not,
were discussing this on a
God
previous
bless her.
episode because
Yeah.
Dennis is an author as well. And before he became an author as a younger man, he had the foresight to record interviews he did with a group of men who were members of an LST group that did reunions. And he still has all this footage. But we were discussing, on a previous episode, as living historians, I'm already seeing kids doing Vietnam and Gulf War impressions. And we're thinking 20, 30 years down the road, when these up and coming authors are wanting to write about their fathers or their grandfathers' war, it's with the Gulf War in the early years, yes, there's going to be some handwritten letters, but in the later years, it's going to be more, oh no, that was sent through MySpace messages or AOL Instant Messenger or Yahoo Instant Messenger and MSN communities and
Good point. Good
all that
point.
stuff's going to be gone. There's going to be
Yes,
very little
and
content
Mr.
except for.
O'Connor, just like imagine the historians of the future deciphering LOL, OMG. It's just not it's not compelling writing.
Here's a
Even
conversation.
the World War II soldiers and sailors from World War II, even if their spelling was atrocious, the way that they formed and constructed their sentences was just gorgeous. It didn't matter if he was from the hills of Arkansas or some kid from the Bronx who maybe didn't go to school. They knew how to get across what they were trying to say, and they did it beautifully, and we were just so fortunate to have that.
The equivalent to you guys finding written documentation now in 30, 40 years is going to be like on a forum. Hey guys, I was doing some research. I found a 128 megabit byte card out of a Sony CyberShot from 2005. Anybody know how to recover these photos?
That's
I was
true.
told it
That's
belonged to
true.
a Gulf War vet or, somebody fighting over
Absolutely.
in Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, granted, we're going to have 1080p, and nowadays with the Ukrainian war, 4K drone footage and everything else, we're going to see the ugly, nasty side of it, but we're going to miss out on the firsthand accounts of it, with the
So you are
exception of the
so lucky,
vlogs.
sir. So the sister then, she's the one who had the letters.
The older sister, his older sister, kept all the letters, and even some letters he wrote home when he was trying to make it in show business. So,
Whoa.
and then Jim Hetzer's daughter published them in a book. So even though I went down to Dallas and interviewed them, all I had to do to read these 300 letters was order this book from Amazon.
That's amazing.
And I tell you, my copy is so dog-eared. There are sticky notes and stars and, red marks and highlights and all that. I really, it's a work of fiction, but to be able to read the day-to-day stories and complaints and positive things made it possible. I certainly wouldn't have been able to do this without that resource.
I've been doing this podcast for 6 years. I've been doing living history for 10. I grew up in Rickenbacker Air Force Base in Ohio when it was civilian place, but I went to air shows all the time. I know at least five people who own Jeeps. I've seen Jeeps. This is a game changer. The fact that I've never heard about any of this, Dennis has never heard about this, Jeff hasn't. The first thing I thought when I started reading this book, and we'll get into a detail here
Good.
soon. One of the events we do here in Florida, which we used to do in Georgia, is to make things fun, even if on Saturday after the Alabama event, we would open this thing for the public. One year we had the local jazz band come do orchestra shows, and we put on a USO show. And my friend Paul, he's a short, kind of chubby guy. He does a perfect Costello. And then we have a tall, lanky guy. And so what we're doing, not me, I'm not taking credit for this, but Jeremy Petrella and his guys up in Georgia, they would get old Bob Hope transcripts, old Abbott and Costello. So Paul and somebody would do the whole work. He's on first. And then someone would come out and do an entire bit where they would just change the name to the town we're in. And we would put on a USO show. But in order to do that, you need a room with a PA system. Right. Now Paul can just grab Chris's Jeep, pull it up in front of the audience at the end of a living history event, and do his Who's On First. Jeremy could sit on the dashboard. He's a great acoustic. He always, after the crowd goes home, he's always playing 1930s and 40s Eric Kreck songs around the campfire. Yeah. We could turn this into a living history display at one of our World War II weekends because we always have Jeeps. We got talented people.
Oh, I want to be there.
So,
I want
to
be there for that.
So easy to do. So I'm going to talk to my guys, and maybe next year at VKE or one of our events where Chris or somebody has their Jeep out there and Paul's there and Jeremy, you can so easily do the Special Service Corps
and you
do
run
a
the
Jeep
you
show.
Run the mic you run your mic off the battery.
Oh, Jeremy and his guys out of Georgia, they do Signal Corps. They have all kinds They have all kinds of audio equipment, so we can make this happen.
I love that idea.
Man. So let's talk about the book Jeep Show.
Sure.
As we said, it's a novel, but you had a, no pun intended, novel idea. You came up with the character based off of who you're talking about, but you also based a character off of another famous person and kind of intertwined it. Let's give the elevator pitch on your book, and then we'll get a little more detail on that.
Sure, sure. Jim Tanzer, the protagonist, joins the Army in 1944. Because of his background, he gets assigned to Special Services, what I call Morale Corps, as an entertainment soldier, as we've discussed. We follow him through training camps, and we accompany him on the Queen Mary troop ship, which is how my father got to the European Theater of Operations. So that had special meaning to me. He meets Mickey Rooney in training camp, and they are shipped over as part of a large show called Hip Hooray. Cast of 45, another 40 or 50 soldiers supporting it, orchestra of enlisted men. As soon as they get to England, the show is broken up. The Army, as it usually does, never tells them why. You can surmise that by that time they wanted smaller shows, more mobile shows, and they get assigned to Jeep shows. He is, we accompany Jim in Paris, where he meets a certain kind of soldier that most of your audience probably knows existed, but I didn't really, and that is the crooked GI who has a side hustle or a main hustle of basically stealing American equipment, although the preferable item was cigarettes. And one of the
and I think they prefer to be called acquisition specialists. They didn't steal. They acquired and filled out acquisition forms. And to your point,
they liberated.
They liberated. And to your point, we see that in another historical fiction book and movies to the far extreme, which would be Catch-22. Advent of the syndicate. So we see it on the far extreme version of the syndicate.
Yes.
Catch-22.
Yes. Yeah, I am. That is Catch-22 is a work, I think, of genius. I stuck to I'm not into magical realism. I wanted to follow very carefully what I envisioned one soldier in Jim Tanzer's shoes would do. So he's in Paris, and then he is assigned to a Jeep Show squad with Mickey Rooney. They are doing shows all along the front line. By that time, the American forces are basically on the German border. All your listeners know that. They got there in about September. And the 28th Division, which is one of the main divisions in the book discussed, the 28th Division and a few other First Army divisions are basically assigned after the Hurtgen Forest slog. They are assigned to the Ardennes, to a section of the Ardennes, to defend that line, but it is basically for R&R and to fit in replacements. Nobody, not sure how much we should have, but we did not expect the Germans to attack through the Ardennes. We did not expect the Germans to attack at all, and we certainly did not expect them to attack through the Ardennes. Jim Tanzer, the protagonist, is with Mickey Rooney doing a Jeep show in Hosingen, which is right on the German border, the Luxembourg-German border, and he gets stuck there. He gets left behind by his crew due to an accident, and he's certain he will, just get back in a truck the next day. He gets stuck there, I should tell you, on the evening of December 15th, 1944,
Just a day.
and of course, he'll get back the next day in the first supply truck, going back, he does not, and he is basically on the front lines when the bombardment starts, and we follow him chapter by chapter, and from Hosingen he retreats to Clairvaux, where 110th Regiment was headquartered. Things aren't going well in Clairvaux. From Clairvaux he retreats to a road. To a essentially a roadblock in a crossroads called Antonio Schaff, and from Antonio Schaff, that roadblock is overrun, and he retreats to Longwy. Longwy is overrun, and he retreats to Bastogne, and he sticks in Bastogne for until it's relieved.
I want to point
Like
out because.
the
Let me say this real quick, Dennis, and I'll pass it over to you. I just wanted to point out, much like the movie Midway, people think, oh, it's a movie about Midway. No. Jeff and Dennis and I have talked about the movie Midway talks a lot about the Pacific. Chances are, if the HBO miniseries around the Pacific wanted to be the Pacific, they would have called it the Pacific because that movie covers a lot of ground, and we think it's a great movie to get people caught up on that area of the war. Much like your book, yes, it's in a trooper in Bastogne. But the first half of your book takes you, the reader, through history up to that point, plus the back history of him, being introduced to acting and singing and his love for the arts. And so you have the nice flash back and forth, back and forth. But this is a great historical ride. It's not just, here's a story about the Jeep show stuck in the Bastogne for, an entire book. You have a lot of history in here. And Dennis and I were talking about this before the show, and I'll hand it over to Dennis. But if you're a listener of the show, you're our age, maybe you got a young son, a nephew, a grandson, what have you, who kind of shows interest in World War II, but they don't want to read because reading's nothing but memorizing dates and names and logistics. This is a great book to get people started because clearly, sir, your knowledge on World War II shows in this book. Because the way you paint your scenery, your descriptions of walking the audience through this book, where you're painting a description of the graffiti of in German, and then the
Hey.
Kilroy was here, low stamp. The way you make reference to M1 thumb without saying M1 thumb, the way you talk about how Jim has thrown away all his stuff except for his spoon. Only people who know that soldiers only keep their spoons are usually living historians or people who get way too involved in the mess kit of soldiers. The guys who say, here's a picture of the guy in on D-Day, and if you notice, he only has a spoon in the legging strings. The fact that you make references to stuff like that, it's like, oh, this guy isn't just an author who decided to do a story on World War II and through it. You clearly know your history because you mix it in here. It's all mixed in here. Like Dennis and I were saying, you clearly know the topic because everything from uniforms, referring to lemonade as battery acid, the reference to only carrying the spoon. There's so many little quote unquote Easter eggs in here that lets the well-known audience know that you know about the topic, but it does such a great job that when you're reading this, even if you're not a World War II aficionado, you do such a masterful job of painting that image into the reader's mind of what's going on and what your characters are seeing and experiencing.
Thank you. I became slightly obsessed with the M1943 field jacket. that is for sure, because it is clear that, wow.
It's a reproduction, so you don't have to get
that
excited.
Special. Yeah,
I had my jungle sweater on and my Jeep cap, and I was going to put this on and tell you, you know, I shaved my beard. I can pull 32 off, but I'm in Florida, and even though it's 70, it's too hot for this. But if you need like a character portrayal of your 35-year-old Jim, if I shave, dye my hair, I can pull off 35. What is up, everybody? So if you have yet to decide to sign up for Patreon, please head over to patreon.com/D410. Sign up for the December member prize giveaway. This month, we are thrilled to feature the beautiful exclusive print from Military Aerospace Art, showcasing the incredible bravery of First Lieutenant Huey Lamb Jr. The stunning piece captures a historic mission on March 19, 1945, with Lieutenant Lamb piloting his P-51 Mustang, the Etta Jean II. Intercepting and destroying a low-flying Ardo 234 jet. Don't miss your chance to own the slice of World War II aviation history that is autographed by Huey Lamb Jr. Thank you guys so much for your continued support through 2024. We're looking forward to 2025. Happy Thanksgiving, and we love you all.
Well, when we do the Jeep show. But yeah, in fact, there were three pieces of equipment that absolutely I became obsessed. One is the field jacket because, you know, they, as you well know, they threw away their backpacks, you know, their and whatever they were going to carry, they stuck in their field jacket. Obviously, the M1 Garand rifle, and then the rocket launcher, you know, which is now known as a bazooka. But and I became so interested in just how dangerous it was to be firing a bazooka or loading a bazooka in a combat situation. In fact, one of the things that they tell novelists or would-be novelists is don't do too much research before you write your first draft, because a lot of what you learn will end up being edited out. I did not follow that advice because it's just so fascinating. It is so fascinating. So I probably added an extra 2 years onto the writing process.
It shows. I was going to ask you how long it took to research this book, because it's all there.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't agree with that at all. I don't agree that you shouldn't research.
Right. Right.
The readers, this is one of the points. I have so many points.
Yeah,
so many things that I want to say, but one of the things that really stuck out to me, and it's specifically to that point, was that readers, especially voracious readers, they know if you didn't put in the time, they'll know, and it comes. I don't know how it comes across. If it's part of the universe and the energy that just gets imbued into the text, but readers know. And it just stood out to me so starkly, even the way you foreshadowed by using the 106th on the Queen Mary.
Yeah.
Like, oh, they're going to feature. I mean, I don't, you know, of course, you know, historically we know what happened to the 106th.
Right.
Was that had to be a conscious choice to use that particular division.
I was looking at when divisions were shipped, and I think I put them on 1 or 2 weeks later, but I was trying to get realistic about who actually went on the Queen Mary in late September. So I think I got lucky that it was the 106th and the foreshadowing. To your point, Dennis, as a writer, I Hemingway, and I've read a little Hemingway, but he said something that's along the line you were saying. He said, the what you show the reader is like the top of the iceberg, the part of the iceberg that shows above the water, but you have all this knowledge and, underneath the water, the reader senses it's there, but they can't see it. And to some
Oh, I love
extent,
that.
that's what you and I are talking about, in that you do a lot of research. So the things you, if you do that enough research, the little things you pick are coming from a wealth, a deep understanding. And even though you can't write everything you want to write and all the
For sure.
details, because it just makes it too long, what you do write about comes from this deep understanding, hopefully. So,
That's right. And then you don't, that's just, I love that. I love that what Hemingway said. And then you don't fear talk shows. You don't fear podcasts. You don't fear, right? You don't fear going to a World War II convention because you're a subject matter expert. You're the SME. And you didn't fake it to get it in the text. You did the homework. And
Now, I will tell you, I would not appear if we were talking about the Pacific War, of which I know a great deal, but not enough to be on your show.
listen, I even like your choice on the cover that you didn't put a Jeep on the cover. Like that's a kind of smacks of show don't tell. Like I just kind of feel like if you put a Jeep, if you had put a placed a Jeep on the cover, people would just assume, oh, it must be about Jeeps and maybe it's about Jeep shows that across America where people have antique Jeeps that they're showing and maybe it's a catalog or maybe it's, classic Jeeps. But you didn't. So that's what intrigued me right off the bat was, well, there's just these dudes, and man, that emblem sure resembles the 101st patch outline, and that's a spotlight, but there's no G. So you know what I mean? It was just like, wow, you just totally captivated me with the, and I got it, and I'll just tell you.
That and the young
I can
man.
count on two hands the number of fiction books I've read in my life.
All
Just
right.
personally, just personally, I've read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books. But just personally, my own preference, I really feel like there's just been so many amazing things that have really happened. I don't devote hardly any time to fiction at all. And Bob, I gotta tell you that I did 80 pages last night of your book, and I've been thinking about it all day. I have been looking so forward to getting back into it. When you write a book that you think about it during the day and you can't wait to get home so that you can get back into it, I mean, there's no better compliment than that.
No, it's that's really, really gracious of you. Going back to one thing Don said also, when I'm also a nonfiction reader, obviously. I do read some fiction. But there are people that you have to tell a story. If you want them to learn about what it was like in the army in World War II, what it was like in the ETO, what it was like in the barracks, you have to tell it in a story form. And that's what I set out to do, was tell a story that people would find interesting, even people that are not like us, in what we're interested in. And along the way of telling the story, get across some fundamental points. One of the most important points I wanted to get across that I learned along the way was the difference between the army and the rest of the services. And in fact, I wrote a at the there's a character in the book called the Reporter, and he's a war correspondent. And he explains a lot of things to Jim Tanzer, the protagonist. I wrote he's a fictional character, but I had him write a kind of summary looking back in 1946 about the war, and I had him write four paragraphs about the United States Army If you'll give me permission, I'll read them to you now.
Please.
This is in the middle of a column that he wrote that, by the way, never got run. My last words have to be about our boys who went to war on the ground. They were in a completely different army than the armies of the other belligerents. Germany's was an army of professionals up until late in the war. The Red Army was filled out by peasants and factory workers with guns at their backs. The British Army reflected that nation's traditional class distinctions. The Japanese Army was its own feudal society, emphasizing loyalty to superiors and a strong sense of honor and self-sacrifice. By 1944, all four of these armies were wasting assets. Only America's army was increasing in size and power as the war neared its end. The American army was larger than the nation's other military services combined. Unlike the Navy and its Marine Corps and the Army Air Corps, the army had to rely on the draft to fill its ranks. If the other services were to some extent cherry-picked from American society, the army was America itself, a cross-section of all of the nation's geographic, religious, economic, and ethnic groups, including Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, also known as the three fighting faiths. In the service of victory, we invented both the atom bomb and the idea of a Judeo-Christian nation. The Army drafted Americans from the economically backward South to the bustling industrial cities of the Midwest, from the fisheries of Maine to the timber country of the Pacific Northwest, from the Wyoming ranches to the garment factories of New York, from the North Dakota wheat fields to the Mississippi cotton fields. The Army drafted PhDs. The Army drafted immigrants, who the Army taught to read and write the language of the country they served. It had to be this way, given the manpower needed to fight a world war on two fronts. It was also fitting, given the ideals America said it was fighting for. America fielded millions of citizen soldiers who disliked the goddamn army, were ambivalent about their officers, and resisted the trappings of military hierarchy, also known as chicken shit. Yet many of them will remember their service as the ennobling experience of their lives. If you ask them, they will tell you they fought not for their country or for lofty ideals, but for each other, for their buddies, to get the job done and get home.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I really wanted to tell that. So my editor made me cut it from the book, so I put it on the website. But the army was America itself, in all its different facets, all in the army. And the protagonist was in the army, and I try to show some of the different ethnic groups and characters that he is with.
The outline of this book, because of the theme, Jeep show, USO shows, stripped down version, as you say, the yeah. K-ration version of USO show.
Yeah. Yes.
You got Mickey Rooney, you got reference to vaudeville, you have fictional characters. Two questions. Obviously, one is more of a statement and an assumption on my part, but sure. I would assume having fictional characters, even if they are loosely based off real people, it allows you the freedom to tell a more wide swath story. Because once again, if you write a true story about a true individual who may have seen one or two campaigns, right. You're stuck in that realm. Whereas when you have a Jim Tanzier, and take this for the spirit in which I intend it.
Yes.
The way you write this, he's almost like a Forrest Gump-esque character, as in that he is the conduit that allows you, the author, to tell multiple historical series in a way that you couldn't otherwise tie them together using true characters.
That's very insightful. And in fact, one of my favorite reviews on Amazon is, the title is Forrest Gump Meets Band of Brothers.
Yeah. And once again, it's nothing to do with That's the intelligence awesome. Level, but yeah, I'm reading this. I'm like, this is like, you know, his character allows us to go through these different things.
Right.
And since this is a book about a comedy troupe, if you will, that allows you the freedom to and try to interject comedy in some of the most gruesome storytelling you possibly can. And as I was alluding to in last episode when I was previewing this, when you start reading this book, it reads almost like if you read it, and if you're a visual reader like I am, when you're reading it, you're visualizing scenes in your head. It reads like almost like not as goofy and as blown out like an Airplane or a Zucker's film, but the comedy is hidden there. And one of the examples I give, the boot camp scene, they're talking about the M1 thumb, and you hear grenades in the distance. You hear grenades in the distance. Then they're having a conversation. Ambulance drives by. It's like the scene in Airplane when they're up in the tower and the guy's in the background sniffing the glue and something happens. If you're just reading, you're not paying attention. You don't pick up the fact that the ambulance is going to the grenade pit because the rookie just blew up a sergeant. And so the comedy is there. And if you read it slow enough or you just pay attention to what you're reading, the comedy is there. It reads like a movie or a TV series. And it's such a pleasure to read. And I'm sure that you wouldn't be able to have that freedom without the fictional characters.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. In a way, when you do fiction, you can cram three or four different soldiers' lives into one life. And the biggest reason is I wanted this soldier to be involved in the Battle of the Bulge. And the gentleman who inspired me was not caught in Hosingen on December 16th. So that the heart of the book, the absolute heart of the book, was, you know, the ability to put him in different scenes that you know, I wanted to tell those stories.
I do got to point out there's a whole lot of Jeeps missing from the Jeep show. a lot of great action. If you're trying to get more information on, you know, what size alternator to put in a 42 Willys, it's not there.
Right.
But
right.
It's such a great book. Dennis, I know you have some more questions.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
Please.
Oh, first off, Mickey Rooney. I mean, I grew up watching Mickey Rooney, my grandmother and my mom. Like, I just watched. I recorded all the time AMC, that channel, American Classics.
Yeah.
And you nailed Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
Did you watch a lot of film on him? And
I watch some film. I'm mostly a reader. So I read his autobiography, and then I read his second autobiography. The thing that struck me about Mickey Rooney, I've always been interested in the concept of genius. And there's a great saying, talent does what it can, but genius does what it must. You know, Mickey Rooney was an absolute genius. Marlon Brando, his director, said that he was, other than Charlie Chaplin, he was the best actor they ever worked with.
My goodness.
Now, where there are great strengths, this is the problem with being a genius and why we're glad we're not, or at least I'll speak for myself. Where there are great strengths, there are great weaknesses. Mickey Rooney's was off the rails his whole life. He was an absolute wild man. He had bees in his bonnet. He was probably a gambling addict. He was probably an alcoholic. He was very active socially in Hollywood with all sorts of women.
I mean, Ava Gardner, for God's
sake. Yeah, he was married to the most beautiful woman in Hollywood, and he cheated on her. So, yeah, they called him Andy Hardon at that time. So, yeah, Mickey Rooney was an absolutely magnetic character. And he also, his career faltered badly after the war. And to some extent, it was already faltering, you know, at 5'1".
Yeah.
He was getting too old to play Andy Hardy, but he was way too short to be a leading man. And so, and he had some terrible business ideas as well. But one of the things if I write a sequel, I want to explore Mickey Rooney in the bad times, you know, because he ended up having to make a living, but he would go to cocktail parties and do a routine at somebody's house for a cocktail party. And, you know, they gave him $20 or $50.
Heartbreaking.
But he stuck with it. You know, he never gave up. He never gave it up. So fascinating character.
That's
absolutely
like
fascinating.
That's so lovable.
That's the old time equivalent to when you see actors doing cameos now, where you know,
right.
I'll send you $50 and say happy birthday to my friend Steve. Right. He's a huge fan of you and Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. So
I hadn't thought about that, but that's exactly right. I think it has more dignity than those cameos. But,
yeah, because that's a smaller sample size get to see your dignity.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like back in the day, struggling actors, they would go over to China or Japan and do commercials that would never be seen here. Because, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, if you were an actor, you didn't cross over to TV. You know, your goal was to go to TV and the movies and never look back. So the movie stars would go do commercials in, you know, China and Japan, knowing that they won't get played here. But once it became cool to do both TV and and then obviously with the internet, everything's open and good to go.
Yeah.
I loved your the book is full of Easter eggs for everyone listening.
Thank you.
For everyone listening, this book is full of Easter eggs. It's got something for everybody. I mean, that'll probably be a project I do one day to see how many Easter eggs I can find and compare it with other guys doing the same thing and see how many numbers we come up with. Yeah. The reference to the Road movies. I mean, I freaking loved that.
Yeah.
And because growing up as a kid, once again, Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, the Road movies, and Dorothy L'Amour. And it was just, that was so great. Referencing the CCC. Not everybody's going to catch it, but
The civilian. One of the things my editor did was make me get rid of a giant chapter I wrote about the Civilian Conservation Corps, and I had to shrink it down to that page and a half. But such an incredible American adaptation to the Depression.
Yep.
You know, young men from struggling families could go and they would get three solid meals a day. They'd be given a uniform. They'd be out in the woods. They'd be actually, you know, making things at, you know, campgrounds and, you know, trails and parks and fighting forest fires. And I think they got paid, you know, $50 a month and 35 of it got sent home automatically. They weren't even, you know, because the people back home needed that. So, and
it was loosely, Army themed as far as the organization. We had Wild Bill Garnier's son and granddaughter on here.
Really?
Yeah. And they were talking about how he was in a Civilian Conservation course before he even signed up for the Army and Airborne. And because so many high school pre-college age men did that, and because of the loose Army logistical organization, because anytime you have that many people in an area, you got to have organization,
right?
And so the people who really strived in that environment, it was an easy transition to go from the CCC into Army boot camp, and kind of as we were talking earlier off video, kind of having a foot ahead of everybody else.
Yeah. They wore, in many of the camps, they wore World War I uniforms. They were issued, you know, they were issued World War. So, yes, it was an army before we had a big army.
And those structures they built are still standing today.
Absolutely.
Still being used. I visited my grandmother up in Baraboo, Wisconsin. There was a CCC camp nearby, and the guys that worked there, they were refurbishing and building up what became Devil's Lake State Park there in southern Wisconsin. And the buildings are still there. They're made of stone. And my grandmother met Delbert Brond there, and they started dating and fell in love. And he was in the CCC, and when the war started, he became a top turret gunner on a B-25, and he was killed in August of 43 in the Pacific. So he never got to marry my grandmother. But I did track down his family. I talked to his brother, and they still have his CCC footlocker. When you open it, my grandmother's pictures are still taped inside. Isn't that something?
That's beautiful.
That is amazing. That
so that reference amazing. To CCC, just like, wow.
Yeah.
I got to ask you as a writer, I mean, what is your process for keeping track of all of your characters and when they're going to intersect. You have, is it digital? Is it an Excel spreadsheet? Do you have post-it notes on the wall?
He's got a CIA room in the background with red thread going to
photos. Right. Right.
Do you mind sharing?
No, I don't mind at all. It's a little embarrassing because I don't think I did a great job of it. I just, took so long to write it that I could straighten out my problem. I outlined the chapters, what I thought the chapters would be early on. And they pretty much stayed the same. So I had, and then, as you know, each chapter is kind of a day. So it's a little simpler there to make sure, like, oh, I left Jim in Bastogne and I forgot about him. And now I forgot he has to move to Berlin. Because I outlined the chapters early and because of the very simple, not easy, but simple timeline, I didn't have a big problem with, keeping track of who's where.
Is it that simple timeline that allowed you to paint with such vigor when it came to your descriptions of sceneries and timelines and adding in those Easter eggs that we discussed earlier? Because one of the things I kind of noticed, and for a younger audience or the video game audience,
yeah.
And the reason I said that this book is a great introductory to some people who may be showing some interest in World War II, but maybe a little afraid to dive deep into biographies, this almost reads kind of like a video game tutorial. Like for one, and what I mean by that is when you first play the older games like Call of Duty or Medal of Honor, as your protagonist is going through the early chapters, he's having conversations, and you as the narrator kind of put in the abbreviations, then you kind of briefly explain what it is, almost as we're here to briefly educate you on this, maybe this item, this term, what have you. And so you really do briefly, without talking down to the audience, you kind of bring the people who aren't up to speed on the knowledge, you kind of bring them up to speed somewhat quickly, but in an entertaining way. And so this is a really good book to kind of get people who have a little bit of interest, maybe who want more interest without getting diluted with dates and logistics and all that.
Thank you. I definitely wanted it to, I didn't want it to read like code for people who aren't like us.
For sure.
And my editor, the developmental editor, the main editor, told me up front that she was a World War II buff, but I found out that she wasn't at our level. Because, she said, what does this mean? What does that mean? Oh, and okay. So it was very helpful because that's where I would go back. And, even something as basic as the ETO, the first time I used that, I was careful to say European Theater of Operations, because I do want the story to work for people that aren't like us.
When you mentioned the red ball,
like us, There's a lot of Easter eggs and fun
there's
stuff.
There's a ton of Easter eggs.
When you mention the Red Ball Express, you briefly give a half a sentence explanation of what that is and the people involved in that. And that's what I meant earlier for the audience, that this is more than just a book about Bastogne. There is a whole lot of World War II content. The humor's there. The writing is fantastic.
Because the whole point of writing your book is that you have something inside you that just has to be out. Like it has to be out. It's not even an option. And if you don't get it out, you're going to be out of sorts, and you're going to be miserable. So because you want it out, you want others to read it, and you're longing that they're going to read it and they're going to enjoy it and they're going to appreciate it. Not so much that you did it, but they're going to appreciate the story and they're going to learn something from it. And you, as a minion of the grand architect who gave you that desire, you take a lot of joy from that. And so doing nonfiction, I learned a lot from Mitch Weiss, who I did The Heart of Hell with. And I and the reviews that I've been getting on my books is that folks are like, I sat down to read a page and I'm 100 in. Mm-hmm. I don't even realize I'm turning pages. So I feel like I did it right. And this Jeep show, I mean, even sitting here right now, I cannot wait for this podcast to be over because I want to get into the book. And I don't mean that wrong at all. Right. I'm just really super excited, but that says a lot. From the moment you open up Jeep Show, you're immediately there. And it was like I was in a movie. I didn't feel like I was reading a book.